From Stanford University and KZSU, this is the Stanford Storytelling Project.
And that led to a lifelong confusion for Chuck Berry about whether rhetoric could be trusted or whether it was always something that would bite you back.
So, welcome everybody. We are here today, a very special event for the Stanford Storytelling Project. We're here with the Composition Blues Band. All of you already know of the Composition Blues Band, undoubtedly. Their fame is far and wide, not only in this country, but all over the world now. For having recovered so much of the original rock and roll of the 20th century, And we're very lucky to have them in the studio today, unplugged, doing some acoustic versions for us of some of their most famous songs. And I'm going to have a chance to talk to them in a rare interview. As all of you know, even Rolling Stone couldn't land these guys. So we are very lucky to have them here. As everyone knows, have been around for quite some time studying rock and roll and helping to recover from the archives the true songs, the real roots to a lot of modern rock and roll. And people were shocked when they first came across these performances of how rock and roll emerged, and particularly how incredibly invested rock and roll was in the writing process. I think for all of us, like me growing up, I had always thought of everybody from Elvis Presley to Elvis Costello being kind of more into sex, drugs, sometimes politics. But I never really realized until I began listening to you guys just how truly they were invested in writing, and particularly for you guys, the trauma of the writing process. So I wonder if... maybe you want to just tell us a little bit about an early moment when you first discovered a song or how you got started. You can do a kind of start at the beginning kind of thing.
Well, we've been doing this work for nearly 20 years now. And Clyde and I first met in graduate school at the University of Arizona. And we originally studied fiction writing, but then we
also moved a traumatic experience.
Yeah, that was a different kind of traumatic experience. But when we continued on to do more graduate work in the field of rhetoric and composition, and we started to do some archival research, we found something very surprising. And like you, Jonah, we'd grown up listening to the radio and hearing all the classic rock and roll songs from Chuck Berry on. And like you and most listeners of rock and roll, we thought that rock and roll was mostly an exploration of young love, sex, drugs, rock and roll itself as a subject, cars, getting away from home. What we discovered in the archives was that pretty much every song that's played on classic rock now, back then it wasn't classic rock, it was just rock, but now it's called classic rock, nearly every song, the original lyric had to do with the writer and singer's experience of writing in some way, either as a student or in many cases as a teacher, sometimes as a writing program administrator. And once we realized that, we decided that we owed it to the not only to scholars but to everybody to recover the original lyrics that were about the trauma of having to go through writing education in the United States, which most people, I think, would agree that the rite of passage, which is most prominent in young people's lives in the United States, is something like the first year required writing class.
I got to say, when Marvin started doing this research, I had reservations because, these guys, I mean, it's one thing to have, some jail in your past, a drug addiction, but... I think these guys had buried the trauma of going through composition so deeply that it really took some digging. Now, I wasn't sure how they were going to react when we brought all this to light. It was, we didn't want to damage their reputations with this background, but we felt obligated to bring it to light.
Yeah, rock and roll was seen as an explosion of true emotion. You know, that people were finally able to reveal what they were feeling and thinking. And what we found was that rock and roll is founded, it's rooted in a repression. It's a repression of severe pain. And that lie could not be allowed to continue. The lie had to be revealed, and people had to face up to a pain that they'd rather not face. The pain of being in a writing class or teaching a writing class or trying to run a writing program. And of course, as Clyde says, this is not something that people wanted to give up, the repression. So we've faced criticism. We've been booed off stages. We've had hors d'oeuvres thrown at us at conferences. But the work is more important.
Have any of the writers, the songwriters, or any of the performers contacted you directly and complained, or did they feel like they were at least eventually glad that some of this repression was lifted, that they could sort of come out of the closet about?
You'll remember the night that Bob Marley came to you in a kind of vision or dream. It was after a heavy night of drinking. I think that was the night you stopped, actually, but. Bob Marley seemed to think that the tune that we had discovered from him was that he liked having it come to light, I think.
Yeah, he was okay with it. I still have the dreadlock that he left in the room that night.
Yeah, it was good. He was okay.
And he said, it's okay, man. Was basically what he said. Not everybody's felt that way. Elvis Costello still won't speak to us. We see him sometimes like on Letterman or something, he'll right. be on, and he basically looks the other way and spits, and so he's
that.
Not happy. He still insists that his songs are about like girlfriends, like Allison or somebody like that.
We know the truth. It was painful. Yeah. Elvis was a friend, but
he's an angry guy. I don't think I'd be surprised if he ever gets over it. Really,
you know, with his looks and the glasses, he had a lot of trouble with street cred anyway, and you know, the composition background wasn't helping. So I think we should dig out a couple of these songs of trauma. As Marvin said, some of them explore the trauma from the student's point of view, some from the teacher's point of view. And those all really cut to the heart and produce a lot of painful laughter. Why don't we choose a couple of these, Marvin?
Well, I'm trying to think of what would be the right first song for this session.
Here's the one that George gave us. He's the one who dug it out. George Thorogood. The Delaware Destroyer.
Yeah.
He actually offered this one himself, which was which was pretty surprising.
Well, he was pretty
Was he aware he had sort of come to this himself and wanted it to be recovered, or
he was young. I think he looked up to the CBB, as an example to him about cutting to the bone, being honest. And he had written the song, and then he wrote a second set of lyrics, and he realized, well, you know, the first set was really what it was about.
Yeah, Thorogood was pretty open. Of all the people we've encountered, I think he was most open. He didn't go to school for a long time. He started in the University of Delaware. He didn't last very long, and he didn't like his writing teacher, and this is a song he wrote about that experience. I was feeling all right with the draft turned in. That teacher of mine threw it in the trash bin. Do it all over. Start it all over. Do it over. Keep a log. You better log what you put in. She told me to change all of my favorite stuff. The surface changes wouldn't be enough. Do it all over. Start it all over. Do it over. Keep a log. You better log what you put in. She questioned the claim I made on page 4. Now my proof don't fit no more. Do it all over. Start it all over. Do it over. Keep a log. You better log what you put in. She made lots of comments, no pity and no pleas. She cut every sentence off at the knees. Do it all over. Start it all over. Do it over, keep a log. You better log what you put in. It looks like I'll be changing every line. It'll look like hers, it won't look like mine. Do it all over. Start it all over. Do it over, keep a log. You better log what you put in. Do it over, keep a log. You better log what you put in. '90, '95, even more, close to 100% of our lyrics have had to come through our research and not through people sharing the original lyric with us.
And what were some of the first ones that you discovered? I mean, how did you sort of start down this road, just bringing us back to the beginning?
Well, Chuck Berry, one of the supposed fountains of rock and roll is Johnny B. Goode, and it's a song about a rock and roll show and a country boy who learns how to play the guitar and becomes famous. That's not what Chuck Berry was writing about at all. Chuck Berry had a brush with the law early in his life when he was a teenager. It came about because he was reading about rhetoric and in the library of his hometown.
It's dangerous knowledge.
Dangerous knowledge. He was so impressed by what he read, particularly the rhetoric was not about perfect truth, but about contingent truth. And he went walking in the fields outside of his hometown, and he was just full of this knowledge. And a man in a 52 Chrysler, I think it was, drove and stopped and said hello to Chuck. And Chuck was just so full of this rhetorical excitement that he started to describe the nature of rhetoric to this man. Turned out that this was an evil man. And after Chuck had described that rhetoric could be used for good or for evil, the man pretended to be as impressed as Chuck was. And he said to Chuck, I'm so interested by what you're saying that I'm just going to walk around the fields for a while. Here, take my keys. You can drive my car, take it to the motel in town, and I'll just walk back into town later. Chuck, innocent, accepted the offer, took the car keys, drove the car back into town, and was arrested. The man had reported that his car was stolen, and this led to Chuck Berry being put in jail for a period of, I think, 12 to 18 months, maybe even a little longer than that. And that led to a lifelong confusion for Chuck Berry about whether rhetoric could be trusted or whether it was always something that would bite you back. And so he changed the lyrics to disguise what had happened to him. But we were able to find, by going through the records in Alabama, we were able to find the original lyric for Johnny B. Goode, which is Raytor B. Goode.
Before the modern era, 500 BC, they overthrew a tyrant down in Sicily. The people there contested every point they could. Taught by a sophist boy called Raytor B. Goode. He never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could argue both sides as persuasive as hell. Go, 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 Raytor, go, go, go. 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 Raytor B. Goode. When Raytor got no tenure down at Syracuse, he went peripatetic, yeah, he got real loose. Wearing out his sandals, rambling Athens way. Those Greeks all gathered round to hear that Raytor play. He said, I bring you practical philosophy. And the thing about truth is it's contingency. Go, go. Go, Raytor, go, 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 go, go. Rager be good. Now Rager was a speaker of such wizardry, made the best appear the worser for a modest fee. His potent words had power close to absolute. Don't ask about his ethics, boy, that point is moot. When Plato had a problem with that oversight, he begged him, Rager, be good tonight. Go, 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 go. Go, Rager, 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 go, go, go. Go, go, Rager, be good.
Wow, it's kind of a revelation to hear this as an acoustic. I mean, we're so used to, even in your own versions, hearing this sort of stomping electric classic. This is one of those folks at home, man. You want to cut that one out. This is going to be on one of those expensive compilation CDs in the future.
Yeah, feels a little naked out here without the amplifiers and the band,
yeah,
the stacks of Marshalls.
We don't want to hide, so the acoustic versions, I think, allows a certain way of getting across to the audience. So what I'd like to point out about that lyric is that Chuck Berry is becoming part of a conversation that's lasted roughly 2,500 years about the nature of rhetoric. So in this song, Rhetor be good is really a call that's been made from Plato on. Rhetor, be good, and don't give in to the evil, like that man who gave Chuck Berry his car keys and ended up having Chuck sent to jail in its own way, almost like a Socrates moment, although Chuck didn't have to swallow hemlock and die. But he did lose an important part of his youth to rhetoric.
Are there other artists who you were drawn to who similarly kind of have this epic struggle with rhetoric? It's not just the writing process, but can language be used for good or evil, or can it come back, like you said, and bite you? Were there other songs that really touched you?
Elvis Presley.
Yeah, absolutely.
Elvis Presley certainly followed Chuck Berry in the tradition, and I think of Chuck more like a Plato, and Elvis more like an Aristotle, and Elvis certainly wrestled with the duality of rhetoric. Is it good? Is it evil? And he really lived in that confusion. And this is a song that's about that place where he ended up spending a lot of his time.
Ever since my Plato left me, I found a new place to dwell. Among doubts and probabilities in the rhetoric hotel. I'm so uncertain. I'm so uncertain, baby. I'm so uncertain I could cry. I said to Aristotle, please get me back on track. He handed me some lecture notes. Read these and you'll get the knack. It's just a techne. It's just a techne, baby. It's just a techne. Don't you cry. A guy dressed in a toga said his name was Cicero. Everything about everything is all you need to know. Knowledge and virtue. Knowledge and virtue, sonny. Knowledge and virtue show the way. Ever since my Plato left me, I've found a new place to dwell. Among doubts and probabilities in the rhetoric hotel. I'm so uncertain. I'm so uncertain, baby. I'm so uncertain I could cry. I'm so uncertain I could cry.
So Elvis certainly saw the danger of rhetoric. He saw the practical uses of rhetoric. And in that song, he invokes the masters of rhetoric, Plato, Aristotle, Cicero. And I think to the end of his life, Elvis was not able to make a final decision. And I think a lot of his alcohol problems, a lot of his drug addiction had to do with that inability to choose a side and to have an allegiance to the good of rhetoric or to the evil of rhetoric.
You know, even the last hit he ever had, last number one hit he ever had, Suspicious Minds, mm-hmm. It's still about the uncertainty that he just couldn't come to grips with.
Yeah, and that came from basically watching the news. He was watching PBS, which Elvis, you don't think of Elvis watching PBS, but pretty much every night he would watch an hour of news. And, and that phrase, Suspicious Minds, could he even believe the people on PBS, McNeil, Lear, the people who came before them, he just never knew who to trust.
You're asking about, you know, some of the early bands that we knew in the old days, and for me it was the Stones. And they were just kids when we met them. They come to America, and they when they talked about those days afterwards, they changed it a little bit. They talked about going to Chicago, meeting Muddy Waters and those guys. But I got, you know, again, not to brag, but they met us first. Came out to Arizona, met us first. I taught Keith a few riffs, and in the biographies that came out after that, I think they were ashamed of those early beginnings in the composition thing, and they kind of buried the songs. So, you know, what can I say? But I think the song that became Wild Horses is a good example of their early stuff.
Yeah, well,
That we definitely influenced.
Usually artists like the Stones, and, you know, being gentle with them, our artists like the Stones, usually thought of as taking over the American rhythm and blues tradition. American singers like Elvis were accused of the same thing.
Right.
But also the British, and what they appropriated, the key appropriation was not of the rhythm and blues tradition, the key appropriation of the British rock bands of the late 50s and 60s leading up to the British invasion was the appropriation of the experience with first-year composition. There is not such a tradition in Europe. When people go to European universities, they generally do not take a required writing course. And when Mick and Keith were in school, they were listening to the radio, and they had some bootlegs of material about writing that was since hidden, and we had to recover it. But there were a few bootlegs back in those days, and what they realized was that there was a musical tradition that they wanted access to, but there was also an experiential tradition of taking first-year writing courses. Sure, they could write songs about girls, but they couldn't write songs about writing without laying claim to an experience that they themselves had not had. But the song Wild Horses, as Clyde was just mentioning, is really about the experience of writing a research essay, which, again, they never had. But it's to their credit that they're able to write so convincingly about that experience that they never had.
Research assignment. One third of the grade. The teacher's intention to see of what I'm made. Now it's the last minute, and the library's closed. My internet connection is kind of indisposed. that's what the guidelines say. Three to five sources, I will find them someday. My choice of topic, which the teacher must approve. It should be in the public interest, so there's opinion to move. So I started with abortion, because it worked back in high school. My teacher said that was off limits, so I switched to fossil fuel. Three to five sources, that's what the guidelines say. Three to five sources, I will find them someday. Evaluate assertions, construct an argument sublime. Try some academic journal, not just Newsweek and Time. Documentation, the proper form for every site. It is called plagiarism. If you come off too erudite, three to five sources, MLA or APA. Three to five sources, I will cite them someday.
Oh man, I'm so glad you played that one. This is, if you're just joining us, this is the Stanford Storytelling Project in a special, very rare interview with the Composition Blues Band. We're talking with these famously elusive and reclusive artists who really changed the face of rock and roll over the last couple of decades.
We like to call it retinroll.
Retinroll.
Thank you.
Right. I'm just so glad you played that one because it brings up something you have in that song. You know, Mick was singing the original lyric about the internet, and this is at a time when, really, before the internet, I think was even a glimmer in the eyes of, I can't remember who made the internet. Al Gore, right?
Yeah, that's right.
I'm wondering.
He never wrote a rock and roll song though, so we don't have anything by Al.
You've pointed out that a lot of the lyrics of these songs that you've recovered in your archival work and then went on to perform yourselves have this quality of prescience where they really look forward into the future. You even came up with a term for this. I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the term is the Cosa Nostra Damas effect. And a lot of it has to do with a phrase people probably are familiar with, rock and roll heaven. If there's a rock and roll heaven, there must be a hell of a band. Well, what we discovered in doing the research was that there'd often be references to things that hadn't happened yet, the things that had happened 20, 30 years in the future, particularly the songs about technology, like Wired World by Cat Stevens, and Ghost Riders on the Web, which is an old country western song. And it was curious to us. And what we came up with was that for a rock and roll artist, it's like there's a club which eliminates the boundaries of time and space. And these people have a gift of seeing the future. So Mick and Keith, even before the internet was invented, could make a reference to the internet being indisposed. And we see that over and over again in the lyrics that we recover.
You know, we've had so many kids contact us over the years and tell us they appreciate these lyrics because it really, it captures the angst, the agony of being in the composition class. And these kids today with the internet, they don't know agony. They don't know, you know, the guide to periodical literature and the countless hours and that kind of thing. You see a song like 3 to 5 Sources. I mean, you know, losing your girlfriend or boyfriend's one thing, you know, heroin addiction, maybe that's, you know, but I'm telling you, there's nothing like the agony of getting those 3 to 5 Sources. And the kids have appreciated it, I think, across the years.
Yep.
It seems so obvious retrospectively that these songs had to be about these experiences. But yet, until you said it, until you brought it out and performed it, it was totally hidden. And this machinery that you talk about was just so effective. And so, I mean, growing up and re-encountering these songs in your performances for me was always that moment of thinking, man, I knew that the truth was there. I just couldn't put my finger on it. And then I'd hear your performance and think, ah, there it is. There it is. That's me. That's what I went through. Mm-hmm. High school English, college writing, and then, of course, you know, myself doing some teaching here and there. Same thing.
Sounds like when we met Dylan, again, young guy in the village. We were playing the clubs. He was like 19, little skinny kid. And when he met us, he said, I'll never forget, he said to Marvin, you know, if my lyrics could come close to those old time lyrics about composition, you know, I'd feel I was really close to it. I was really, it was, this is the real stuff. This is the genuine close to the bone stuff. For him, it was Woody Guthrie and the CBB. Were really, you know, the two things he talked about. In the recent autobiography, actually, the editors took out the material about the CBB. They didn't want the composition stuff in the recent memoir by him.
This is what led to that big fracas in the New York Review of
big
Books.
Big fracas in the New York Review of Books. What about the composition? What about the real influences? Yep. And
it was amazing to get. I mean, Salman Rushdie came into this and really to defend.
Oh, they took out
Rushdie
took
came out of hiding just to weigh in on this thing.
Took out his whole basically that whole part of his career that you know they wanted the myth to continue uncensored untouched.
Which is a shame. You know, he had brilliant things to say. I mean, the whole debate about the modes, it would have been shorter and more focused, I would think, if we had just accessed the Dylan material about the modes.
Well, sure. Dylan, while he was writing all the folk songs that made him initially famous, he was initially influenced by American folk traditions. And at the same time, he like Elvis, was earning his degree in rhetoric and composition. I think it was at NYU. And he spent some time at the City College of New York. This was before Adrian Rich and the movement to open admissions. So this was in a much more restrictive time. And when Dylan was first asked to direct a writing program, he hadn't had his breakthrough yet to the electric guitar, which caused all that outrage. So he was still very much a formalist. And what's more formal than the rhetorical modes? So the first writing program Dylan ever ran was a modes-based writing program, and he wrote a song about it.
La, 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 la. La, 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 la. when you have to tell a tale. Description when you must have more detail. Exposition when your facts are on parade. Persuasion when your aim is to persuade. Old man Montaigne just hit the road. Everybody must use modes. They'll mode you when it's causes you assess. They'll mode you when discern more from less. They'll mode you when you draw a clear contrast. They'll mode you when you compare first and last. How can you tell the tadpoles from the toads? Everybody must use modes. They'll mode you when you must define your terms. They'll mode you when you classify earthworms. They'll mode you when the sets must be discreet. They'll mode you when your sets must be complete. How can you tell the line's been towed? Everybody must use modes. Modes are with you when you get up out of bed. Modes reflect the way things are inside your head. Modes are with you when you sit down in your seat. Modes are with you when you're tapping out a beat. It's how your brain arranges heavy loads. Everybody must use modes. They'll mode you when you want to find an answer. They'll mode you when you divide dance from dancer. They'll mode you when you want to ponder why. They'll mode you when you want to sit and cry. Let's break my nature's secret codes. Everybody must use modes.
Oh, I'm so glad you played that one. This leads me to another question, just while we're on the on Dylan. Marvin, you've been famous for how you can adopt the vocal styles of anyone from Jagger and Dylan to Don Henley to Elvis Costello. And I just wonder, you know, what do these artists think of this? Like, you're known as this sort of chameleon, and I wonder what you've thought of the controversy around this.
Well, most of them don't like it. I think voice is a very personal thing. If you look at Moffitt's work, personal voice, lots through the 60s and 70s, so I'm respectful of that. But my answer to those criticisms is that the truth of these songs doesn't belong to any one individual, and that I think it's helpful to the listener who's hearing a recovered lyric for the first time to hear it. You know, I don't take any great... I don't think of myself as someone who can really duplicate Bob Dylan's voice, but I try my best in terms of when I'm singing a Bob Dylan song. I want the audience to hear that voice, and that voice is part of a larger conversation. So if somebody comes up to me and says, don't try and sing like me, I'll say, well, I'm not really trying to sing like you. I'm trying to represent your voice in a larger conversation, and I think that takes precedence over any individual's ego.
This has come up a lot when you do what some critics have referred to as your cross-cultural work, where you're singing in the voice and in the style and bringing to light lyrics that were done by people from very different walks of life. I mean, you could maybe identify with a Buddy Holly or an Elvis Presley, but when you really started branching out, I think that's when... some of this controversy erupted, but I wonder if you'd be interested in maybe doing one of these songs. I know that
especially the folk stuff when Marvin started discovering the, you know, the tunes that were so old, the folk tunes. It wasn't clear who the author was, but these were embedded in the cultures and the experience of being in the composition class again, teaching the composition class, these things were embedded in the culture in ways that were just undeniable. And, you know, whether people wanted to hear it or not, you know, Marvin had to bring it out. And that's what we did.
A song like the one we're going to do next, you know, we do most of our work in the second half of the 20th century. But when we discovered this lyric to a Spanish-Mexican folk song, we found the lyrics in Spanish. And we actually had to get a friend of ours who used to play in the band, a mariachi, a violinist, who used to be a member of the band and still is, actually. She can show up whenever she wants. But she helped us with the translation because she was a fluent Spanish speaker. And when we started to perform the song, complaints about appropriation, we've talked about appropriation a couple of times with you, and we've been accused of appropriation of other cultures. What we're trying to do is show that the trauma of writing is not limited to 1950 to 2000 America.
It's universal.
It's universal. Universal.
The universal requirement.
So when we found this one and had it translated, we weren't pleased about the trauma that people were suffering, but we were heartened to understand and realize and have more evidence that this was not limited to a particular group in a particular time, that this was something that was shared across national boundaries, across linguistic boundaries, that this really is a universal pain that people feel in learning how to write.
And it's interesting because these songs have actually often been your most popular, most requested songs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. People love them or hate them, I guess.
Well, I'm glad you're here to play some of them for us. So what are we going to hear?
Well, this is a song called Quantas Palabras, which is a question that students ask. It's often the first question students ask when a writing assignment is given. Quantas Palabras? How many words? Soy estudiante sincero y yo trabajo bien duro. Escribo todo el día a terminar mi ensayo. Y antes de componer tanto hay un número que ¿cuántas palabras? Ay, dime cuántas palabras. ¿Cuántas palabras? Ay, dime cuántas palabras. Soy estudiante sincero.
I am a student sincere.
Y yo trabajo bien duro.
And I work very hard.
Escribo todo el día.
I write all day.
A terminar mi ensayo.
Just to finish my essay.
Y antes de componer tanto.
Before I compose too much.
Hay un número quiero.
There's a number I want.
¿Cuántas palabras?
Dime.
Ay, dime cuántas palabras. ¿Cuántas palabras? Ay, dime cuántas palabras. ¿Cuántas palabras? Ay, dime cuántas palabras. ¿Cuántas palabras? Ay, dime cuántas palabras.
Wow, thanks. That was, I mean, as people know, this is one of the most requested songs. And
they want it all the time.
I think it's because, again, like this is this universal theme of how we, as creative as we might feel, as excited as we might get about an assignment or creating some sort of story or essay, we all have that moment of, well, now, how much am I going to have to produce? How many words am I going to have to create here. And that just, that, especially the mournfulness that you give it. This is like one of the things that critics have also noted over the years about the Composition Blues Band, is that it's not just an archival project, it is a performative project. And I think that's what makes the CBB sort of the treasure that it is.
Well, you know, we've lived the life. Some people are writing songs about things they don't know about, but Mara and I, we've been there, we've done that, we have lived the life, and I think you can hear that.
Well, you know, we're coming close to the close of our hour, sadly, and I just wanted to ask you a little bit about your latest work. I mean, there have been rumors on the internet about some new research that goes kind of far afield from your traditional stomping ground of the late 20th century. I wondered if you would be willing to divulge any details about where you're headed next.
Well, we're just starting this work, so there's nothing to perform. We haven't recovered any lyrics, and since we don't read ancient Hebrew or ancient Aramaic, it'll probably require finding scholars in that part of the world to help us. But we're excited about some initial insights we've developed into the Old Testament. As everyone knows, the Jewish people were slaves in Egypt, and we've pondered the meaning of the pyramids, and it's becoming clear, and we've worked with scholars in the Mideast about this, that the pyramids themselves are representations of essay forms. And if you think of a pyramid that has a point at the top and then moves to a broader base, that represents an essay that begins with an anecdote or a particular story, often called a hook, and then it moves into a wider area, a wider topic to explore. And so what we now know is sort of that kind of opening, to start with the specific and move to the general. You look at the pyramid. I know that Clyde has a different view of this. He thinks of it as an inverted pyramid. And I think you think of the pyramid basically as the funnel, but just turned upside down.
Yeah, it's a basic difference. It's a controversy in the field. The Egyptians were onto it, passed it on to the Greeks. We're going to agree to disagree about this one.
Yeah, but I see the point. I just don't agree. But if you think of the pyramid upside down, or if you think of it as pointing to the sky, as pointing to the heavens, I can understand the point that you could start very generally and then gradually narrow your topic to a thesis, and your thesis is a gift to God. And I think that was in the minds of the Egyptians as well as the slaves. So both interpretations of the pyramids are in play currently with scholars. We've been working with some interesting people over there. Shmuel and Shana Punim at the University of Jerusalem have become good partners. A friend in Egypt, Ibrahim.
He's the famous banjoist. Is that
he plays the mandolin? Actually.
Oh, the mandolin.
Yes, he does jam with us. And Shana is a wonderful cook, and she also plays the dulcimer, the hammer dulcimer. So they not only are scholars, but they're musicians.
I got to say, Shmuel's a heavy partier too. It was visiting him was a deal. It was like the old days. It was a blast out of the 60s.
I'm glad he's not going to hear this, because he'd be insulted. He's trying to get past those days. Our Egyptian contact is Ibrahim Smook Kamel. He's also been a big help. Avram Rugelach at Haifa has been a wonderful help. And a French scholar, Maurice Mandelbrot.
A great baker,
yes, absolutely.
Like never
Some people think he's a little bit on the edge. Some even call him nutty, but we don't share that view of him. He has a brother, Benoit Mandelbrot, a famed mathematician who works with fractals. And when he and Maurice were growing up together, they were baking together, and Maurice used to criticize Benoit because all of the pastry they made, no two pieces looked alike, whereas Maurice wanted them to look even. We've also worked, I think those are the people we've worked with. I think I've mentioned all of our colleagues in the Middle East. Here are some findings recently, still being worked on, none of this is final, but Jewish people still celebrate Passover, the commemoration of the Exodus from Egypt. But some of the texts we're examining from that time suggest that it's not Passover, it's Classover, and that the time in Egypt spent as slaves of the many, many generations were considered a long, long, long writing class, and the Jews could not be released from bondage,
be released
from assignments, assignment after assignment after assignment, the labor of writing draft after draft after draft. And the Exodus is actually Classover.
Classover.
Yeah. And run through
parted
waters.
Yeah, really, yeah.
And then,
it feels so true. I mean,
yeah, so true.
Well,
in
the Old Testament chronicles the time right after that when the Jews were in the desert and Moses went up to the mountain to receive the commandments. And the Jews lost faith, and they thought that they needed to go back to their old ways. And they fashioned, and we think of it as the golden calf. It was really the golden draft. And they felt that this draft would be the last thing they would ever have to turn in, and that would absolve them from ever having to write another paper.
Yeah, but look what happened to him after that.
Well,
never think the last draft is the last draft.
Well, what happened was Moses came down from the mountain carrying the tablets, which was God's syllabus for the Jews. And he was so offended by seeing the golden draft, as if one could assume what the teacher wanted, that he dropped the syllabus and it shattered into many, many pieces.
Oh, my.
And that was... to say the least, very bad news for
this
for the
really
Jews.
Solves the riddle of that.
Yes.
Him dropping these stones, right?
I mean, yes, and it was the 10 assignments, basically, not the 10 commandments.
Right.
And these were the 10 assignments that were supposed to be completed between Egypt and the Holy Land. That should have only taken about a semester. But because he broke the assignments, he broke the syllabus, God decided that the Jews had to spend 40 years. Talk about a long class.
That's a long class.
That's a long class. And Moses, because he broke the syllabus, as people know from reading the Old Testament, was not allowed to go into the Holy Land.
They gave him an incomplete.
They gave him an incomplete.
Wow.
That's
the first incomplete.
The most famous incomplete. In recorded time is Moses' incomplete. He never was able to finish the class. He was just taken straight up into the classroom where he stayed.
And again, we come back to this trauma, this like root woundedness.
Yes, thousands of years old, before the Greeks. Mm-hmm. This is before people like Plato and Aristotle. This goes way back. So I'm hoping that our future research will show us even more about how to interpret properly the Old Testament. And we might, you know, years from now be going from town to town reading the revealed version of the Old Testament. And let's hope there's music, otherwise we'll just be up on the stage speaking into microphones.
I mean, this is just going to dwarf the Nag Hammadi and the Sea Scrolls, and I mean, this
absolutely,
is going to
change.
Absolutely.
It'll change everything.
Yeah, it's going to make the Da Vinci Code look like the Hardy Boys.
Like a crossword puzzle, nothing. Yeah.
Man.
So we're looking forward to it.
Yep.
Boy, it sounds like you got your work cut out for you. I guess it's going to cut in a little bit into the partying. I mean, particularly
we're writing grants, and we've heard that Alexandria is a partying town. So I think if we can get some of these grants, we'll be able to spend fair amounts of our next few years.
And not to embarrass anybody, but the weekend we spent with the Hasids, I don't even remember most of it. It was wild.
Well,
so we'll
sure.
definitely be visiting.
There are parts of Jerusalem I wouldn't walk through at night.
No, not without one of the boys.
No.
Well, listen, I want to thank you both for being in the studio today, and I think I can speak for all of your legions of fans that we are looking forward to the Old Testament songs and anything else that you might produce, and I think you know what I'm going to ask you next, which is one of your most famous songs. I know you haven't played it in a long time.
Are you going to ask for the song?
But, I have to say, you know, I'm one of those people that when something becomes really popular, I tend to just move away from it. But this is one of those exceptions. I have to say, I still love this song. And I just wonder if I could impress upon you just to do an acoustic rendition for us, just to kind of dance us out of the interview.
Yeah, this is a Richie Valens song. Actually, he adopted it from a Spanish-Mexican folk song. And just a little bit about the background of this song before we do it. Richie had a healthy sense of humor about being bilingual. And when he was attending school in what town in Texas was it?
He was in, I don't know, small town.
Yeah,
Texas.
Small town.
Wasn't
Texas.
Ever in Lubbock?
No, Lubbock. That was Buddy Holly. So oh, it was a different town. So somewhere down there. And he wanted to learn proper, quotation mark, English, but he was bilingual. So a lot of his language was a mix. It was Spanglish. It was a mix of English and Spanish. And this song has that real feel of all the songs we do. This is perhaps the most joyous. Most of the songs that we've talked about this hour are songs of pain. But Richie Valens, it's so sad that he died so young, because he might have had the capacity to bring a certain
levity
and joy into yeah. contemplating yeah. the experience.
You know, people think the day he died, of course, is the famous day the music died yeah. and all that. But what people don't know is he left the monograph about commas unfinished. And it would have been his contribution. It would have been the work entitled was "The Joy of Punctuation." Mm-hmm. It really would have changed things. But all that unfortunately went with poor old Richie.
Well, I think that's a fitting tribute, though, and a nice way to close our hour together, to go out on something. Born in the blues tradition, out of trauma and woundedness and oppression, but rising above it. So. Thanks for being here, and thanks for indulging us in one of your most revered and loved songs.
Our pleasure.
How shall I come? How shall I come? Se necesita coordinating conjunction. Coordinating conjunction, si no tiene semicolon. Yo no soy comma splicer, yo no soy comma splicer, soy capitán punctuation, soy capitán. A comma. Para poner un punto. Para poner un punto. Se necesita una sentence completa. Una sentence completa. Con subject y verba. Se hace completa. Yo no soy fragment maker. Yo no soy fragment maker, soy capitán. Punctuation, soy capitán. A comma. Nunca usa first person. Nunca usa first person. No necesita opinión subjetiva. Es opinión subjetiva. Si no tienes los facts todos. Yo no soy ego hombre. Yo no soy ego hombre. Soy racional. No digo yo. Soy racional. Comma. A comma.
Wow, thanks a lot. Amazing. Well, that's it, folks. My thanks to Marvin and Clyde, leaders of the Composition Blues Band, here for this very rare interview with the Stanford Storytelling Project. Well, I hope that we get to talk to you again, especially after all this new research that you're embarking on, and hear some of the new material. So thanks
Thank
again
you.
For being here.
Thanks Glad a lot.
To be here.
See you again.
This week's show is produced by myself, Jonah Willingans. I'd like to thank
Marvin Diogenes and Clyde Munion for their support of the storytelling project over the years and for the fun we've had today. And we would all like to thank for their generous support of the storytelling project, the Stanford Institute for Creativity in the Arts, the Center for Teaching and Learning, the Hume Writing Center, and Stanford Continuing Studies. We'd also like to say a special thank you to Harry Elam and the Vice Provost's Office for Undergraduate Education for their ongoing support. And we'd like to remind you that you can find this and every fabulous episode of the Storytelling Project on Stanford iTunes and on our website, storytelling.stanford.edu. Tune in next week when I believe you'll hear stories about comedy, what it takes to make comedy, the risks, the tragedies, and the wonder that goes into making comedy. For the Stanford Storytelling Project, I'm Jonah Willingham.